Welcome to the Realtors Land Institute podcast, the voice of land, the industry's leading land real estate organization.
Hello, this is Justin Osborne, accredited land consultant with the Wells Group Real Estate Brokerage in Durango, Colorado. On today's episode of the Voices of Land podcast, we're talking to RLI member and accredited land consultant Clayton Pilgrim. How's it going today, Clayton?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, man. I'm glad you're on today. Excited for everybody to hear what you got to say about water usage and regulation and effects that investors can have when buying land.
Absolutely. Excited to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
Give our listeners a little bit of introduction here about you. Clayton is a third-generation Texas farmer and rancher. His background stems from row crop farming, commercial cattle production, logistics, sales, business acquisitions, and advertising. He received his ALC designation from the Realtors Land Institute in 2018 after only 18 months in the real estate business. Along with a successful sales record, he's also an appraiser, farm manager, and consultant. Clayton proudly serves on many civic, community, and nonprofit boards. He resides in Paris, Texas, with his wife, Christy, and their two children. He enjoys hunting, golf, and raising his family.
Man, that's over the top. I like it.
I know, man. Quite the detailed little bio there. After only 18 months, you got your ALC. That's got to be like a record in our industry.
I'm sure there's some one or group of folks that have probably done that or better, but coming from the production side, agriculture, to the first time I walked into Century 21 Harvey Properties and talked to Renee, and a lot of you know them, Renee and Rusty, but the first thing I saw was hanging on their wall was their accreditation plaque. And I asked the question, I said, what is that? And they said, it's something you don't need to worry about. And so I immediately started worrying about it. Did my research, got to looking and really dug in on the, and then I think my first land conference was in 2017. I'm going to say that was in Charlotte. That really got me the fire burning and getting mine done. Obviously, me and you did our land you together. So it was tough. I mean, it was things you really had to put together, and I've still got my book. It's somewhere in the office. Every now and then it gets moved around and I kind of thumb back through it, but there's a lot of work there, but that's kind of the beginning of my career. And after getting that, of course, it's like planting a seed in the ground and then it grows from there. So you, not only the networking, but the energy, the education, the add-ons that come along with that ALC's been huge for my career.
Yeah, that was fun, man. That we need to like go back and do some type of land U reunion, because I guarantee you that we had, I mean, looking at the people that were there now and where those people are in their career, when you look at, you know, Trent Lister in Montana and Dan Murphy in Lake City and, you know, Joey Burns in Montrose, you in North Texas. I mean, it's like the cream of the crop that all came as a result of being at that land U event. And so for our listeners that aren't familiar with that, that's where you can basically go through a crash course, 10-day crash course, and get all your accredited land consultant classes in one setting. And it is drinking from a fire hose education, but I highly recommend it. Man, you will not regret it. And relationships, lifelong relationships, are formed from the time that you spend together in that class. So thanks for reminding me of that, Clayton.
Always a fun time. And like I say, the networking is one big piece of it, but we kind of always look at that and stay on that topic. But I think the big thing that people don't take in is really the education and what you're learning as a agent or a broker. There were guys in there that had been in there, what, 25 or 30 years, have been brokers.
You know, right.
They're in there, yeah, getting their ALC, and they're getting their eyes open. So it's huge.
Never too old to get educated, man. Well, I'm excited to talk about water usage. You know, I mean, irrigation water is so different depending on where you are in the States. But this topic that you've brought up with the water usage and how it's affecting cities and different municipalities around the country and the effect it can have on land is something that I don't see a whole lot of living in rural Colorado, you know, because I'm not near a city, but I'm really excited to kind of hear what you have to say about this. And so just jump in and kind of give our listeners an overview of what water uses are that affect land use as well as land value.
So to kind of look at it in a standpoint of just what are water uses that as a investor or a land agent, let's talk in both terms. Me representing an investor, I'm looking at, you know, my investor that's looking to put into farmland. Obviously that the number one irrigation, that's huge. My development clients that are looking for transitional land, and never thought we would say we had transitional land in my area, but we're getting there. So then you look at development, and you've got your, you know, water for livestock, obviously on your ranching operations or livestock operations, whether that's cattle or goats or whatever, what region you're in, depending on what you're trying to water as far as producing pounds of protein. Another one too, and this one's huge in your area, but recreation and wildlife. That's a, you know, a big water use thing. And we see that in, you know, we're getting down into South Texas. You got these guys, these way, you know, crazy improved hunting ranches and farms down there that they're really trying to produce record book deer and different exotics and things. And, you know, water's kind of a lighter resource in those areas. Obviously west of 35, that's kind of our line where you start getting into the more arid areas. So, you know, water affects all different land types, even though we're not looking at it the same way.
So you mentioned transitional land in your neck of the woods up there in North Texas. And I mean, what are you, hour and a half-ish outside of the metro?
90 miles from Dallas, northeast.
Okay.
The McKinney, north of McKinney, between McKinney and Sherman, back east, a lot of that stuff is slowly, but I would say on the investment side of it has, you know, really pushed forward. But I would say on as far as actual building, it's going to take a while. There's a lot of acres there, just a lot of massive amounts of land. However, you've got a lot of large home developers that have, you know, already bought some of those tracts and put the planned use development, you know, mapping, and they've got everything done within their city or their ETJ, or maybe they have a county that they have to, you know, but these planned developments are coming in closer and closer to our area. We actually appraise quite a bit in that North Dallas area. Amazing to me to see the towns of like Gunner and Melissa and Howe, and these were small farming communities that not 15 years ago were wheat fields and milo fields. And there's still a lot of farming in those areas because those land parcels are still being used as farm to keep the ag exemption, right? But kind of opened my eyes whenever we really got to appraising over there, because you get to looking at comparables, but you also get to looking at these planned developments. And, you know, in a development side of it, a D.R. Horton, or name all your big home builders. That's what, you know, is completely stringent on their deal is having the available utilities, obviously ingress and egress, and they need good roads and schools and et cetera, but if they don't have water, that's the first telltale sign that they're not going to put in a, you know, some kind of housing development. So when you got a client that's looking at some land that's, you know, way over that, the ag value, and I mean ag value, that it makes sense to farm or makes sense to have some kind of livestock production on, you're now into the transitional standpoint, which you see a lot of our colleagues in South Florida or down in Houston area or Austin area, that, you know, those tracts of land have way surpassed their ag value, where they could be, you know, appraised on an ag standpoint. Like, if I'm looking at a ranch now and I'm saying, hey, there's $35 an acre of rent on a $10,000 an acre place, that's not a very good return. So you got to look at it on the standpoint, it's a strategic buy for an investor to know that in the next 5 to 10 years, the appreciation and the turn to the next guy, to the, you know, pre-development owner, or maybe it's an end user that's going to develop itself, it's going to put all the carrots in the basket and walk away with it, where they can, you know, go put in a, you know, a plan development, or maybe it's some industrial complex, or maybe it's some other. So water's a big piece of that. And it's not just, is there a 2-inch line by the road? We got to have enough water to, you know, do 130 housing units and, you know, 100 multifamily units and, you know, 20 commercial spots. I'm making up numbers as we go, but, you know, these big plan developments take a lot of assets and they take a lot of resources. So, you know, water districts, river authorities, municipalities, of course, we got the federal, they got the EPA, Waters of the U.S. We're not going to say that dirty word right now, but you have the state side, like in Texas, we have TCEQ, which they do a little bit of regulating in the sense, you know, if we're going to have I'll give you an example, Cooper, Texas, which is kind of one of those that's out there on the outside of the ring right now, that's starting to become something more shiny for an investor as far as transitional land down the road. They don't have water. They don't have the water asset. So it's like, what are you, you know, you're going to have a private equity come in and put in some kind of utility district, or you're going to have the city of Cooper try to put in some kind of, you know, way overstocked water system to try to help, you know, it's a checks and balances on what they can and can't do. So when we're valuing this stuff, and it's a conversation we have to have with our sellers a lot, and then, you know, water availability of electricity too, you know, all the necessity items to do more building or do more construction and development. So we have that conversation a lot. And
so when you say they don't have water, Is that a situation of the town itself is actually literally on one big water well, or is it that they've got central water, they are just maxed out and they don't have any taps available for purchase?
I go with infrastructure. That's okay. What I always say. And let's use Paris for an example. The last 5 years we have been after our public works guys to get real good numbers on our infrastructure, because some of our infrastructure was built probably in the 20s. Some of it was built in the 50s. We replaced a bunch of stuff in the inner city Paris, but the big issue that we had was wastewater. We got to looking at our wastewater plant. This was when I first got on the city council in Paris. And that was when they took us to the plant, kind of as a tour when you're first getting on the council. They drive us out there and I'd been in several of these, you know, wastewater facilities whenever we were in the poultry business, because that was part of the problem that we had with growing chickens, is you had lots of effluent water or waste, and you had to treat it. And then before it went to a final facility to be treated and in a wastewater, you know, plant at any of your cities, wherever you were. So we toured this facility. And it's literally a Model A, man. It's a rust bucket. It's crazy. It was actually built somewhere in the, I believe in the 50s was the last time it had been restored. It was part of a army base actually at one time out here. But anyways, we got to looking at that. We just did preliminary numbers. And this was back when we first started, and it was going to be about a $60 million project. Fast forward, COVID, et cetera, supply chain, blah, blah, blah. We get to 90 million. Now we're at 105 million. Now we finally got it going. We're rebuilding in the same facility in the same area, but that was a huge undertaking. And we're looking at it in our budget just in the city of Paris, which we're about a $30 million, $31 million budget, and our sewer and water is probably closer to, I'm going to say, $28 million. And, you know, our taxpayers have to pay for that. But it's also, too, it's been a thing that's been kicked down the road for a long time. So you, as an investor, and I'm looking at saying, okay, I want to build 100. I've got the funding to build 150 units. And I'm going to look, we're going to look at all the different demographics and the housing studies that are available and, of course, cost of construction. And we land on Paris. One big issue I see with Paris is they don't have a ton of capacity for their sewage. They got plenty of fresh water, but the sewage is the problem. And you see this infrastructure issue in a lot of towns. We had a large company that was coming to look at Paris. I mean, they were a $1 billion investment. We had all hands on deck. We all got down to, I think it was us, and then I'll just say a community south of us down on 35. The big issue was the sewer plant. And we're not far enough along. If we'd had our sewer plant built, we'd have probably gotten the company. More or less, maybe.
Well, and that's, you know, I'm seeing that all over the place. I just dealt with that in here in Durango, Colorado. And, you know, it's outside city limits, so we're dealing with La Plata County. And the infrastructure, you know, for us, it's well and septics, but the developer goes to county planning and says, look, we're zoned in the land use code, one unit per 10 to 20 acres. So we're going to do 15 acres and we're going to go through and we're going to build these homes on 15 acres. And like most mountain towns, we're in crazy short supply right now, way more demand than we have supply. And so we go through thinking this is a no-brainer. County says, if you widen and pave the county road, we'll approve your project. Even though right next door, there's homes on 3-acre parcels in this other neighborhood. For us to do one home on 15 acres, they say, you got to widen and pave our county road. So just like your situation, my developer says, not these same words, but no, thank you. We'll go somewhere else. So right. We go across the line over into Montezuma County where Mancos and Dolores are. They welcome us with open arms because they want to see growth. And then it's kind of funny, the next week in the Durango Herald, you see, you know, that there's this affordable housing problem and we can't get anybody to build any housing. And you just want to beat your head against the wall because it's like, look, if these towns would have the proper infrastructure in place, not have 2-inch water lines, actually have metro districts or whatever it takes to have the sewer facilities, we wouldn't have the housing problem that we have in most of these towns across the country because people want to build. They're just getting priced out with all the requirements the towns and the municipalities put on them.
The big issue I see, and this, I got my city hat on right now. So the big issue I see, you get into an investor standpoint of, okay, I'm going to go build in McKinney. Well, you go look at McKinney's bond rating. You go look at their fire rating. You go look at all the different due diligence items that a transitional guy is going to look at. They're pretty strong. They look good. Which a lot of their stuff's new. I mean, these, you know, Paris, for example, we should have put a wastewater facility in 15 years ago. But we had a council that couldn't understand that or couldn't fathom that we're going to have to build something that costs 40 or 50 million men. So you look at it and you say, okay, well, your water usage every day, you know, you're going to turn the faucet on, you're going to turn the shower on, you have the dishwasher, et cetera, all the restroom entities that you have to, that you have in a residence. Or if you're looking at it, you know, you've got, you know, your ag usage, your guys that, like, if I'm looking, I primarily try to invest in ag properties. That's something I understand a lot better. And something I think that is, in my opinion, the next 15 to 20 years is going to be substantially important, especially with our Western Texas and Western United States is going to be more regulated on water and what they can and can't do. And so that, they're completely contingent on their water. They don't get the rainfall that we get. So I think more and more of that's coming our way. But then you have this transitional issue and this other piece too that's driving up land prices too. So, you know, water usage is huge. And when you have a growth area like DFW. I mean, there's what, 1,100 a day or 900 a day right now. At one time, it was like 1,500 a day. Are moving into the DFW Metroplex. You're taking that water problem that they have, and you're moving it to the areas to where, and y'all see it in Colorado. I mean, there are certain valleys and areas where big lakes make sense, and you know, Colorado River Authority or Lower Colorado, you would know the authorities better than me, but we have water districts here, you know, the Northeast Texas Municipal Water District, they'll come in and say, hey guys, we're going to build another lake. Well, then you've got, you know, every landowner and pitchfork, and they're throwing everything they can to keep them from coming. But DFW keeps growing, and we're using those water assets there. You know, a good example is California. Some of the best farmland in the United States is located in some of those valleys just outside of LA and Carmel and some of those, you know, areas that are just, when you get on the coast, it's a little different than when you go just east. And you've got some really nice farmland, and from grapes to corn and cotton to some of the finest, you know, orchards in the world are there. A lot of them, not all of them, but some have made it more of a sense to sell their water than they have to grow a crop, you know. And you're growing people, you're growing communities, so you got to have the water. But where do those offsets of crops and stuff go? Now, right now, we're not in that issue because we're planting. You know, corn prices get to $7 or $7.50 a bushel. I can tell you what they do here. I know what they do in Iowa and the I states. They plant everything they can plant, every acre, every hay meadow, because it makes more sense. It makes more money, and it's insurable. So you're looking at it on the irrigation standpoint. The more irrigated acres we produce, get a high corn price, you get the production of these other, you know, maybe it's soybeans that's taking the hit, or maybe it's corn taking the hit. Maybe it's cotton taking the hit, you know, a fiber product that we're needing to grow, or maybe it's some other. So as we grow and grow, we're going to see it more in our country too, because we've built two large lakes in East Texas. I'm going to say that they're probably north of 25,000 acres of surface water. I couldn't tell you the exact gallons and acre feet. It's a lot. Bodart Creek Lake, and then they have Ralph Hall, pretty close to each other. But they've put a lot of pretty good sized ranching and timber and investment properties out of there into other areas. So those guys, 1033 exchange from there, and they go by 30 miles east. Well, that pushes that land price up. Now we have another lake come in. Well, all this water is not for the local community. It's not for Paris. It's not for Ladonia, which, bless Ladonia, they haven't grown in years. But that water is being completely piped and pumped to DFW. Same way in Lubbock, same way in some of your country, your water assets are going to the city. I'm not an advocate for either side. I think there's a plus and minus both sides. But it's something we have to look at. And then you go, okay, well, if we're pumping the water there, you know, they're already in a water shortage. And we're at 48 inches to 52 inches of rainfall a year here. So we can fill these lakes back up. One statistic I found pretty interesting, I was looking at how much water is in the whole world. It's a finite resource. We don't make more of it. We don't burn it. It just goes somewhere else, right? 332.5 million cubic miles of water in the world. Out of that, we're only using 1/100% of that is for human use. That's ready and available. So, you know, it's like we're building more lakes, we're taking up more land, we're taking water from assets that are needing to produce food and fiber for ag producers, and we're selling it because we've got these big cities and municipalities that have taken over. And of course, you get into the eminent domain conversation a lot. It's like, where's the other, why are we not tapping into more resources of really putting some thought into? A lot of that water is underground.
What baffles me is that, you know, depending on where you're at in the country, you're either in a drought on one side or flooding problems on the other side. You know, and it really baffles me that we can send oil from, you know, Alaska or way up north all the way down to Texas in a pipeline. Why is it that we can't figure out how to send water from east of the Mississippi to west of the Mississippi? I mean, that seems like it can't be that hard. The technology's there. What's preventing that from happening?
And if you would talk to any Delta farmer anywhere on the Mississippi River, they would be all about it because they just get hammered with floods.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much water that goes down those rivers. I mean, all that river, you know, authority through there just is constantly having to. I agree. I mean, why wouldn't there be some, you know, drastic pipeline channel or something that would go? But I think then you get into lots of personalities and political, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually it'll change. I think it has to. I think in order for a land investor to say, I'm going to go buy an almond plantation in California, that guy's going to have to be really careful. That guy's going to have to be really careful that's going to go buy a cotton farm south of Lubbock, Texas, that's got four pivots on it, because he doesn't know if his pivots will be regulated to the point where he can only put maybe a quarter inch of water a week. Maybe he can only do so many passes. He may have to change the farming practices that make it a lot less. In my opinion, a lot of that country out west, they've moved it to agriculture in the last 50 to 75 years, probably a lot of it. But it's grassland. I mean, that's what it's designed to do. And, you know, it's dry. There's not a ton of humidity. Cattle do really well out there. I mean, it's, you know, where we are in East Texas, we grow really good timber. We grow pretty, we're more of a you know, younger yearling type cattle operation, in my opinion, that can get to the where they need to be fed out, where, of course, all the cattle are fed out in the West, pretty much. You get into, you know, weather that you can't change, and then we go out there and we grow 3 and 4 bale cotton for 25 or 30 years, and then our wells start messing up. They start going dry. They start doing and it's easy, man. I know a lot of those guys. They run out there, they literally get to cut their pivot on, and then they walk away. We're going to irrigate here supplemental. Corn crop, for example, here, we're going to roughly use, if we use an acre foot, 325,000 gallons per acre of water, that's a lot. I would say closer to 6 inches. You know, this year we've got some soybeans under pivots here locally that we've been really paying attention to and watching that were later in the year. And now it's been a good 30-day drought. They've been running, you know, half an inch of water a week is what we're going to run here. And those soybeans will do everything they're going to do anywhere else. You look at it on a West standpoint, those guys are going to run pivots the whole time.
Have you seen anywhere in Texas where they're starting to put meters on those pivots? I mean, they started doing that in the San Luis Valley up here in Colorado a few years ago, and it just bankrupt a lot of our farmers because they can't afford to do that. Are you seeing water regulations on the farmers in Texas like we are?
Certain aquifers, yes, and water districts too. There's water districts in South Texas. There's, of course, you have the Oglala Aquifer and all that out west. Those guys are not everybody, but there are certain regions that they've done studies to where their depletion is so bad that they've had to go, and mainly in that Lubbock, you know, territory there. And you go out there and they're still just plowing. They plow, and it's like, you know, you get the dust storms and everything, but that's the old mentality and the old farming practice of we're gonna plow it up and then we're gonna irrigate the, you know, we'll just pour water on it to make it happen. So that, yes, we haven't seen it as far as well regulation here. Now you have your normal Clean Water Act, I believe is the legislation that regulates you from doing, you know, huge industrial type, like if a company was coming in and they're going to drill a big water well for production within a company or you know, some kind of industrial, they're going to be regulated. You have the 404 exemption in the Clean Water Act for ag use. So we use that a lot for building reservoirs. We do a lot of reservoir. We'll build a, you know, however big a reservoir to hold water to run our pivots because we don't have a ton of groundwater. It's not really, it's not feasible at this point. We can build a dam and hold however many acres of water we need to make it work. But.
Well, Clayton, let's say we've got a listener that's a land agent. They've got a client that's kind of on the edge of growth. Maybe it's been slow to get there and they need to help, you know, determine highest and best use for their farm or ranch. What are a couple of like action steps? I mean, other than calling up an appraiser like you, what are a couple action steps that that land agent, land broker needs to kind of keep in mind for valuing that property?
I go by simple supply and demand. There's supply, you know, then demand is even. If there's a high demand, then supply is low. So, you know, water-stricken areas, you know, Southwest Texas is a desert. So in those areas, I would be very cautious in going and saying, I'm going to go buy an operating farm and I'm going to upgrade the irrigation in the state, you know, because those areas are poised for higher regulation on usage. They just are. And right now everything's green and we're good. And, you know, they get a big rain, but I go back to like 2011 in Lubbock, Texas. Right before the 2011, they had a heck of a crop. Right before that, it was a dust bowl. It was so dry. The Edwards Aquifer was way down. The Ogallala was down. Everybody was, oh my God. So I think we had one, when did we have our last one in 2021, I guess, up here, but we all get dry and all of our lakes get 7 or 8 foot. So I would really pay attention on the areas that are, you know, there's ways to buy in areas there that are okay. And then also too, you may look at different usage. What is the highest and best use for a low water quality farm in New Mexico? Well, it might be a better deal to go back to grass. Maybe there's some kind of government conservation easement or some kind of program there that would fit that asset better long term. In my opinion, we need more surface water. Obviously, we need more consistent infrastructure to make all this stuff. To make it all growth oriented. But I would say as an agent, if I'm looking, I got a guy that's got you know, $3 million. We're going to go buy him a land asset, whatever the four categories, recreation, water, you know, or livestock or development or crops. I'm going to look at going in areas that, first of all, have the assets, the infrastructure, and also to just general common sense rules on, you know, water. I would say on weather, that's the biggest thing.
Well, folks, if you want to understand more about this topic, reach out to Clayton or find another RLI member near you who understands your geography. You can find them by searching on the Find a Land Consultant tool on the RLI website. And if you want formal training so you can better advise clients on topics such as this, consider taking a Land U designation course. Multiple course topics are offered throughout the year. Clayton, anything else you'd like our listeners to know about this water topic and how it affects the land use and land value?
Find a professional. Justin said it the best.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Clayton, and helping our listeners better understand how these issues impact land values so they can properly advise their clients when they are investing in land. And if a listener wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that, Clayton?
I always tell anybody to go to my website, c21farm-ranch.com, c21farm-ranch.com. My cell phone, email, everything's available there. Reach out anytime.
Excellent. Well, folks, be sure to check that out. And for more expertise on land real estate topics, be sure to check out the RLI blog, follow us on social media, and of course, tune in for upcoming episodes of the Voices of Land podcast.